fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
My name is Jerd. This is Travolta, the Battle of Ideas.
Teresa Correggio, I hope I said that correctly. Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jerm.
Teresa, that's such an interesting name. Your whole name doesn't sound American.
Well, the Z in there, I have tried to kludge so that it has that more exotic pronunciation of Teresa. So that is my own invention.
Ah, okay. But it's got a very Mediterranean twang to it.
Mm-hmm. Coraggio is courage, heart. It's Italian.
I was going to say it, but I didn't want to sound like an idiot. I mean, short of Mao and Stalin, Hitler is one of those names that just, it triggers such a polarized response around the world, no matter where you are. I don't even think Hitler is a surname anywhere in the world.
Yeah, excellent point, because it certainly was not Adolf's patrilineal name.
Well, we're going to get into that. Yes. So you've written a whole bunch about him. Tell me a little bit about you.
Yes. So I am a housewife who is just trying to figure things out for myself. And that's why I don't care if I have an audience. What I want is to teach myself something new every time that I write. So I write on Substack at thirdparadigm.substack.com. And then I've written a book on economics, which is How to Dismantle an Empire. And that goes through 3,500 years of how we got to this place, the invention of money, and also looking forward, how we can get out of it, how we can create a sovereign money system, which again will tie in to Germany post World War I.
Yeah, you mentioned that you're a housewife, but I know what you're trying to get at. You're trying to say that you aren't an expert, but I want to point out that quote unquote experts are the worst kind of people, and the COVID era showed that. Trust the experts, Teresa.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I think that we should all be passionate amateurs, that thinking clearly is a process. And whatever thing that you're applying it to, it's always the same process. And we've lost that art of being able to think critically and systematically.
Your Substack is called Third Paradigm. What is that?
I think that we've been pushed into these false dichotomies, and that in every dichotomy out there, there is a third way of looking at it that isn't just a compromise between the middle, but is something that is looking at it completely from a different angle.
I think Noam Chomsky wrote about that many, many years ago. He said that the parameters of acceptable discourse or controlled discourse allow for people to argue and viciously debate one another and think that they are coming at each other with opposing views, Meanwhile, on the outside of those parameters, there is a series of more truths.
And isn't it ironic that he has now become one of the top examples of that? What sometimes is called the Overton window.
Yeah.
And he is that person who set the debate and narrowed it on Palestine into these acceptable parameters and did not give the real story, which I think on UK Column is being given in a wonderful way by Vanessa Bealey.
So what made you look into Hitler and Germany?
Yes. Yes. Well, it was responding to someone else's interview of C.J. Hopkins. And of course, he got into trouble because he had the swastika that was grayscaled in the background of his cover. And I was, and that became a big thing, I think, in the COVID con, is that many people were saying, oh, what's happening now? It's just like the Nazis. So I responded and said, well, maybe we should take a closer look at that, because the last time that there was any system of sovereign money in the world was in Germany. And how did they recover from the horrible reparations that were imposed on them at the Treaty of Versailles? How did they end up having this economic miracle? And did that have anything to do with everything that happened after that with World War II?
So before we get into it, what is your central argument?
I would say my central argument is that the world wars were not the Allies versus the Axis countries, that they were always Rothschild versus Germany, and Rothschild won, and that I am 100% certain that Adolf was a Rothschild agent, and I'd put 50% probability that he was a Rothschild.
Yeah, you call it the Rothschild paternity theory, isn't that right?
You could call it that, yes. Yes, and that would be one side of it, but I don't think the two necessarily go together. I think really the critical thing is looking at him as a Rothschild agent, but certainly if he is a Rothschild, then that gives more indication of why he would have come to their attention in order to be their agent.
Well, if you don't mind, walk me through some of your research.
Right. So you have to start. Actually, let me just say this first, that I was listening to your interview of Micaiah Freeman. Is that how you pronounce his name?
Micaiah.
And Micaiah did a wonderful job of laying the groundwork, because he talked a lot about how the Rothschilds had engineered the world wars. So he gave a lot of the background on the Great War. He even talked about how Kaiser Wilhelm had offered peace with no reparations at a point where Germany and Austria had effectively won the war. And that fact has been scrubbed from the internet. Now, no matter how you ask AI for it, it can't get that fact from its accepted sources. So after that, then there was the Balfour Declaration. And the Balfour Declaration gave Rothschilds Palestine in exchange for bringing the U.S. in and turning it into a world war. So that was what the Germans called the stab in the back theory, that at the Treaty of Versailles, when that came out, was when they knew that they had been stabbed in the back. So Adolf, the thing that was the clincher for me after all the other research in saying, yes, he absolutely was an agent, is to find out he wasn't even German, that he was Austrian. And Austria and Germany were two separate countries, that Bavaria and Germany were together and Austria and Hungary were together. So he, in 1913, left Vienna, left Austria, in order to dodge the draft, that he would have been subject to automatic conscription. Now, there is no verification of where he was for the last 3 years, from 1810 to 1813. No, I'm sorry, 1910 to 1913 in Vienna. He disappears. And so it is possible that at that time, he's connected with the Rothschilds or people who are within that circle. So he goes to Munich in Bavaria, and they catch up with him. The Bavarian police say, wait a minute, you need to go join the army back in Austria. And somehow he gets out of it. And they say that he wasn't fit for service because of poor lung capacity. So here's the person who becomes this great orator, but he gets excused and not sent to prison, which would have been the case for someone who was a draft dodger. When the war begins, that happens again. He ends up joining the Bavarian army. So he's joining the Bavarian army as an Austrian spy. He is not Bavarian. And then he ends up becoming a message runner. What better position is there for a spy than to be the one who's bringing the messages back and forth between the generals? He becomes known to Hindenburg and Ludendorff. And when the war is over, and he misses the end of the war because he's in a hospital somewhere. So when the war is over, he doesn't leave the army. Instead, he denounces someone else for being a revolutionary. And then he becomes an infiltrator into the different parties that were forming. And particularly, he is told by Karl Mayer, who is the boss of propaganda and intelligence, who answers to Ludendorff and who says that Ludendorff told him to do this. He infiltrates the German Workers' Party, which has the initials DAP. The DAP is where the genius of the German economic system is, a guy named Gottfried Feder. And Gottfried Feder even has that iconic little mustache that Adolf then imitates, becomes known for, that he copies Feder in that way. And so Feder creates this economic plan where basically people are paid for an hour's of work, and it is an exchangeable hour of work that anyone who works then earns these, they may have even been called Feder bills, and that they can then exchange them to other people. And Adolf ends up giving a speech talking about why Austria should not, or why Germany, Bavaria, should not leave Germany and join with Austria, which could have been a very good move for them. And instead, he becomes the head of that organization, but is placed there by Ludendorff and by the intelligence and propaganda agency.
Would Hitler, or Adolf, as you refer to him, would he, sorry, why is that that distinction being made? Why is it just a...
So now I'll go into his patrilineage. So Adolf's grandmother, Maria Schickelgruber, became pregnant at the age of 42 when she, and presumably, well, according to two different sources, when she was working as a housemaid in the home of a wealthy Jewish family. According to the half-nephew of Adolf, that was in a place called Graz, the second largest city in Austria. And it was a...
Hey, it's Bubba Wallace from 2311 Racing. You know what it feels like forever? Sitting on a plane waiting for takeoff. Good thing I've got Chumba Casino. With daily boost and social casino games on tap, this is the kind of fun that makes time fly. Why not turbocharge your downtime? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Family called Frankenberger. And that was later disputed because they said, well, there were no Jews who were allowed to be living in Graz, and there were no Frankenbergers. But if you go on the Rothschild, well, if you look up, were there Rothschilds who lived in Graz, what AI says is, you conspiracy theorist, what are you trying to do? But if you look at the Rothschild site, when they talk about all of their art collections being taken by the Nazis, then it says that the Rothschilds have historical ties to Graz. So there is a presence, maybe not ordinary Jews, but the Rothschilds are living in Graz, and where they got their start was Frankfurt. And so they are, if you were going to disguise the name, Frankenbergers. They are people who came from Frankfurt. So that's why it can't be completely eliminated that Rothschild would be, I think it's Anselm Solomon is the one who is the most likely, would be the father of Adolf's father.
Sorry, I had my microphone off. Okay, so if you don't mind me jumping just for a second, would he have been aware of all of this?
Adolf? I mean, that would be entirely speculative, but he knew that there were rumors and that he hired Hans Frank, who was his lawyer, to disprove those lawyers. And what he gave Hans Frank, according to Hans Frank at Nuremberg, was a pile of correspondence that was between his grandmother and the Frankenbergers, where they also paid for Alois to be raised until the age of 13, at which point Alois then disappears into Vienna. That he goes to Vienna and no one really knows his whereabouts. So if he actually is the Rothschild bastard and they have a policy of not letting that go to waste, then Alois is potentially someone who then connects with them.
So what you're saying is that the timing of Maria falling pregnant while in Vienna is very suspicious.
That, and also the cover story is completely implausible. The cover story is so Alois changes his name he's fairly old at that point. He's in his 30s. He's married to a wealthy woman who's 50, and he goes back and they all say, oh yes, Johann was Heidler, was actually the father. And that's who Maria ends up marrying at 47, but he never claims Alois, and he is already dead by the time that they go back and claim and say, oh yes, he was the father all along. So it's implausible that after his death would be the time that he claims that. And at the same time, Alois comes into a pretty good chunk of money. And the person who was the Rothschild, who could have been the father, dies a couple years before that. So potentially that is part of some deal. The other 50% possibility is that Adolf's mother was that Adolf's father was his mother's uncle. And since they it's a very good possibility that Adolf's father was his mother's uncle. And throughout their lives, they called each other uncle and niece. So that is entirely a possibility, which means that Nepomuk, who was a brother of Johann and who was a complete piece of work, who had three children by that time, that he could have been the one to rape Maria. And I am always going to refer to this, whatever happened, as rape, because the use of servants in this way was so common that one of the things that's cited is that, oh, isn't this awful that when the Nazis took over, they put in this rule that no German woman could be under the age of 45 could work in the household of a Jewish family. So why would they put in that rule? They put in that rule because the rape of household servants was so common.
Okay, take me back to then the rise of Hitler. You were taking me through that.
Yes. So then he writes something called the Gemlich letter that is one his first propaganda piece, and that is something that he's coached by Karl Mayer, who is the head of propaganda and intelligence, on how to write this letter answering about anti-Semitism. Now, anti-Semitism is an actual policy. It was in Germany saying there is an ideology that we are against. Now, as you know from my Substack, I also go deep into biblical sources and I look at the Torah. So what I call it is anti-Shemitism. So Shemitism is what the word Semitism was before.
He was the son of Noah.
Exactly. He is the son of Noah, and he is the one who is given the right to rule over the entire world. And Japheth is to live in his tent, but Ham, who is clarified by Josephus to represent Africa, Egypt, and parts of Asia, is to be his slaves. All of his descendants are to be slaves to the descendants of Shem. And Canaan is to be the lowest of all slaves. And even as an analogy, it's kind of weird because this is Noah giving this curse after he gets drunk, falls asleep naked. I don't know. Is that a thing? And then Ham talks about that. He talks about the naked truth. And instead, Shem and Japheth walk in backwards and cover him with a seamless cloak. And that's why he curses Ham. But Canaan's not even in that story. So why is he cursing Canaan? That is, I think, a very suspicious thing that brings in this whole history. So I am against the ideology that some people are born to be masters and other people are born to be slaves. That is Shemitism, and I am fully 100% against it. The Germans were also against it. And what they said is, it is not that I would put a difference here between people who are in another country can be immigrants where they want to assimilate. They want to be accepted by the new culture. They can be invaders where they're coming as conquerors from the outside, or they can be infiltrators who are coming pretending to be immigrants, but who are really loyal to another country or empire or something outside of that. And what the Germans were saying is that the Jews were infiltrators and that they did not describe themselves as Jewish Germans, but instead as German Jews, that the actual affiliation. And what Adolf was saying is that they are a race, not a religion. And that is twisting that truth a little bit, because really it is a religion of racial superiority. So if you look at it as an ideology, if someone was coming in and assimilating, if they were marrying into with the Germans, they weren't seen as being part of the problem. It was those who were loyal to a diaspora empire. And that's what Rothschild was, that if you look at the most popular weekly newspaper back in 1938, I think it was, it's talking about how he is the king of Judah, how kings and emperors can't make any decisions without consulting him because he is above them. And that's what the Germans were objecting to.
He rose to significance fairly quickly, which of course is always something that should raise alarm bells. What you then suggesting is that he was an agent unwittingly or unknowingly for the Rothschilds, like he was manipulated.
It had to be knowingly. If he is leaving Austria and somehow he knows that he can do that without getting put in prison for draft dodging, he's in on it. You know, for a while, I thought maybe he was just being manipulated. But when I found that out, I realized that he had to be in on it from the very beginning, because otherwise he would never be going and joining the Bavarian army. And what the way that it spun is, oh, he didn't like the Habsburgs and he didn't like the multi-ethnic makeup of the Austrian army. But you're going to war for the fact that a Habsburg has been killed. So if you don't like the Habsburgs, why would he fall to his knees and thank God that the war had started? Because the war has started, presumably, because a Habsburg has been killed. And just to segue to that for a moment, the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand makes the JFK magic bullet seem plausible. It is the hokiest, ham-handed setup ever. You can't even look at it and not know that it's a false flag. First, you know, he's in Bosnia. First, there's a bomb thrown and it misses. It goes between the cars. It injures the people in the car behind him. He goes, storms off, and after a couple toddies or whatever, they say, oh, let's go visit the injured. They go in another motorcade that somehow needs to back up into a side street with the whole line of cars. So he's blocked in, and then they stall, and he happens to be right in front of the backup assassin. There is no way in the world that was not planned.
There were definitely other players involved with the triggering of the war. I think Cecil Rhodes might have been one of those involved, actually.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And so another fact that I didn't realize until I started researching this is that Adolf's position of Reichskanzler was not elected. People never voted for him. It had to be appointed. And so President Hindenburg, and this is another rabbit hole I haven't fully dived down, but how does the general who loses World War I end up becoming president? That I am certain that they threw the war intentionally at that point, that they were objecting.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Did to the fact that Kaiser Wilhelm had offered peace without reparations. And so when they got back into it, they lost on purpose because Rothschild had paid for the entire war. The Germans had never paid for that war. So when Adolf is in this position, all of these wealthy industrialists pay 3 million Reichsmarks to President Hindenburg for him to appoint Adolf. That is a setup, obviously. Oh, and he becomes a German a year before he becomes the Reichskanzler. How's that possible? How's that possible? You're not even a citizen. And a year later, you are the Reichskanzler.
So what was the mission? What was the end game?
Yeah, the end game was to bleed the Germans dry. Certainly to set Germany and Russia so that, you know, they bled each other dry, which is what Churchill said, but to punish Germany for having kicked the Rothschilds out because they had, again, created this economic miracle. They had created the money so that everything could flow. So in monetary theory, there's a saying of that for any city to say, oh, we can't do that because we don't have the money, is like someone saying, well, I can't build this house because I don't have enough inches. That it is entirely a concept, and that in order to control your own labor, you should be able to create as much as you want. So what Germany had done was proven that to the world. The Rothschilds would never have been able to dominate another country through their monetary system if that had been able to catch on, and it would have spread like wildfire. So they wanted to crush that monetary example and make sure that no one ever tried that again.
He was a Rothschild agent, possibly even a Rothschild by birth, right?
Yes.
Okay, mm-hmm. Right. Then why would he have kicked out the Rothschild bankers?
Well, because it's not just him. He has to play the role. And so the Rothschild bankers, that's the entire intent of the German people. The German people are saying they caused the problem. They're the ones who stabbed us in the back in World War I. And therefore, we need to get rid of that banking system. So when the one Rothschild was put in prison, I think it ends up where Himmler visits him and he ends up getting upgraded to being kept in prison in a luxury hotel and then he pays some ransom and then, you know, is able to leave. And all of that ends up coming back to them. Whatever it is that they can say, oh, the Nazis took this away from us, ends up coming back to them. So they're not really worried about that. It's, what's the term, kayfabe, the worldwide wrestling. It's all just fake. But Hitler has to play. He has to play that role so that, for instance, when you have that front page ad that is run where it says that we, the nation of Judah, declare war on Germany.
That was in 1933, I think. I've seen that. That was a whole newspaper front page.
Right. But it had to be much earlier because it would have been before World War II was fully happening.
But that's how I said 1933, not 1943.
Oh, yes. You're right. So they have this front page ad, and who it blames is Hitler. It says Hitler is the one, and that's the reason for this boycott. So what that does is it puts Adolf into this position where he says, okay, in order to placate them, we have to allow all of the Jews to emigrate to Palestine along with their money. And so that's when they put in the transfer agreement, where because they weren't allowed to extricate the German money, instead, what they could do is transfer goods. And so all of the equipment, the heavy equipment that built Israel, ends up being transferred, and then those same Jews cash out. And so they have wanted to erect a statue to Adolf in Israel, because without that, Israel would have never been built.
Yeah, exactly. So I've also read that he already from the late 1920s was discussing helping Jews move to Palestine.
Yes, yes. And that is the game also, because the Balfour Declaration didn't mean anything if no Jews wanted to move to Palestine. And why would they? That would be moving from their cushy lives in Germany and being very wealthy to a desert. So no one wanted to move. And so that's why when you look at the word Nazi, so again, when Adolf joins the German Workers Party, it is DAP, nothing to do with Nazi. He adds National Socialist. Now, socialist is what they're against. They are a workers' party. They say you work and you get paid. Socialism is exactly what they're afraid of, because that's what's being brought in. So why would you add something to the name that would be the opposite of what they stood for? And now that ends up being an acronym of NSDAP, which once again sounds nothing like Nazi. What does sound a lot like Nazi is Ashkenazi. And that's how I think it should always be pronounced, because I try not to use the word Jew. I try to always say someone who self-identifies as a Jew, because the word Jew didn't even exist until the 18th century.
You're correct. I've also read that. I think it was around the late 1600s or early 1700s where the word Jew entered the English lexicon.
Right. But in Hebrew, there's no J. So if you take the word Jews, you know, there's an I that's pronounced as a Y. So if you take the word Jews and substitute a Y, what you get is use, U-S-E or E-W-E-S. And that is what I think all of these different war tribes throughout history have been. They have been used by the same small group of people, the same dynasty that has then chewed them up and made them the bad guys. And I think that will be another iteration here. So Ashkenazis actually have no relationship to Judah, that Ashkenazis are descendants of Gomer, who are descendants of Japheth. So they're not actually even Semites. They're not Shemites. They don't descend from the house of Shem. So it's a stretch. They're kind of distant cousins to even being Judeans. From David Irving, there was never a program of extermination against European Jews that Adolf ever ordered or knew about. There is zero evidence that David Irving used to go in waving.
Yeah, I mean, he was jailed for that. That whole narrative, though, is so taboo that it can get you criminalized in over 20 countries. And you have to ask why. Because if something is true, why do you need to defend it with state-sanctioned violence?
Yeah. I know that's a rhetorical question, so I will not be answering that. But yes, absolutely. Yes, yes. And what David Irving would do is he would go into conferences waving $1,000 and say, I will give this to anyone who can show me proof. And then Ron Unz writes about how he was always a little bit skeptical. And then when there was the lawsuit with Deborah Lipschitz, something like that, that then she had something like $3 million in order to prove that he had distorted this. And all those lawyers had to do was find one little scrap of evidence that Adolf had given this order or even knew about it, that there were plans anywhere and they couldn't find it. So that in a way that ends up proving the case, because that's what they're trying to disprove and they can't do it. In order to be a professional liar, in order to control the opposition, you have to have 99% truth. You can't be seen. People were looking for ways in which he was betraying them. People were very suspicious of him. That's why he ended up hiring Hans Frank to disprove that he was a Jew or a Rothschild, because Chancellor Dollfuss in Austria had found proof, he said, of who Adolf really was and that he was connected to the Rothschilds, and he ends up being assassinated. And that proof ends up disappearing. So Adolf could never have come out and do things publicly unless he was seen as being forced into them. So they kept pressuring him to say, what are we going to do about the Jewish problem or the Jewish question? And that was a very legitimate point, because how do you deal with an entire people who are loyal to an entity outside of your country? That is a really difficult thing. You have an organized group that can depend on having all the forces of money throughout the world being brought against, you know, on their part. So it's not like those are a small amount of people in your country. They're people who have ties to people who can manipulate all of that. So that was a legitimate question. And Adolf kept punting on that. He says, oh, yeah. After the war, we'll deal with that. Oh, maybe Madagascar. You know, which was ridiculous and never really a plan. But he comes up with these fake ideas, but he never actually does anything himself.
Did Churchill know any of this? Or did de Gaulle know any of this? Or Eisenhower?
Oh, Churchill, totally in on it. Totally. Yeah. I mean, Churchill is owned. You know, he had all these gambling debts that he was going to lose his chateau over, and then a wealthy Jew.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Wish businessman comes in and pays them all off. So Churchill was always their man. And going back to, so just following this thread of that, presumably Adolf's father was conceived in Graf by the 19-year-old son of, you know, of this Jewish family. So I look at the Rothschilds and I say, okay, that would mean 1819. What happened? Were there any born in 1819? Not really, but if you go back, that's when things really changed for the Rothschilds, because Nathan Rothschild ends up buying up all of the British government bonds. And then 2 years later, that year, sells them at a 40% profit. How does that happen? How do you, if you buy those bonds, you own that government, nobody has the money to buy those from you unless you loan it from them. And that same year, all of the five children, all of the five sons end up becoming barons. So that is this way in which those were significant years, and that the Rothschilds owned the British government because they had owned all those bonds. So this was the debate that was on my stack for a long time, because we were all in agreement about all these other facts. But the question was, did Adolf simply make mistakes, or did he make so many military mistakes that they had to have been intentional? So he gets Dunkirk and then he gives it back. He says, oh, never mind. He invades Russia in winter.
That was ridiculous. I mean, obviously he was going to lose.
Cunning like a fox. That was let me sacrifice all of these German soldiers. So yeah, so my dad was German. Caraggio is actually my ex's name, but my maiden name is Zembauer. And so my dad, the year that he was born, if he had been born in Germany, 98% of German men died who were born in that year. So it was an absolute devastation. And Adolf made sure of that. He wouldn't let anyone wake him until noon, and he wouldn't delegate military decisions. He was a dilettante. He kept artist hours and needed his beauty sleep. So what?
And a vegan. Sorry, but, yeah. But
no. I'm with you. I'm totally with you there on that. I mean, that is the worst of all.
anybody who struggles to eat bacon and eggs in the morning is somebody I don't trust.
I think every meal should start with bacon myself. So he is operating in a way that is going to make the loss inevitable. And that was the intention all along, because the Germans didn't even want to rearm. They didn't want to go to war. They didn't want to build up this armament.
If the plan was for him to be defeated, would he himself have known that he was going in to be defeated, or did he think that he was still going to win?
No, he absolutely knew. If you look at his supposed suicide, it's like, oh, who was it? Is it Eva Braun? Oh, yeah. She's going to commit suicide with me. We go into this closed room. We shut the doors. He goes to it like it's just another day, according to, you know, his hagiographers. Of course, it was just another day. He never died. You know, never part of the plan.
Yet we know that we know that half of his people went to Argentina anyway.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yes. Yes. And immediately, this is stepping way back, but immediately when he comes into power, there is the Night of the Long Knives. He kills off all of the people who were the true planners of the revolution, against the Rothschilds.
Why Germany?
It's been a century of trying to defeat the Germans, as Michael Hudson says, that even,
well, they are defeated
today,
now.
Well, I mean, you have even things like the Nord Stream, which was really to destroy German industry. So the Germans keep getting back on their feet, and that personally to the Rothschilds, the one Rothschild who was taking over that branch ends up dying with no heirs. So in that way, Germany is sort of lost to them. But really who they have it out for, it seems, is the Habsburgs. And so they keep on killing off different Habsburgs. And so the Archduke, Franz Ferdinand, ends up inheriting all of this power, ends up being the next one in line to the throne. But because he was in love with a lady in waiting, he had made an agreement that none of his children could ever inherit. So by putting that all into one handy little bundle and then killing him off, they got rid of a lot of the Habsburg line. So I think this is one dynasty fighting against another.
Would you say that a lot of your research is based on circumstantial evidence?
How do you differentiate that from history?
Yeah, true.
I mean, if you're talking about circumstance being the context of something, that I think any time that we're looking at history, you have to be reading between the lines. Because once you know that they will lie, that they have lied, then everything becomes a mystery that you have to unravel, that you have to say, okay, well, this doesn't make sense. And so what could have really happened?
And I mean, your Substack is called Third Paradigm. And so you are being consistent. But do you think David Irving, because you mentioned him earlier, would know this also? Because, I mean, he's written extensively on Hitler.
I don't think he came to that conclusion. No. I haven't read his book, Hitler's War. I have it, but it seems to me that actually the conclusions that he reached were more cautious than this. And what I get is the benefit of being able to take his work and build off of it.
It is plausible that he and Mengele, who did die, I believe, in Argentina, did escape.
Right. And it also would not be at all beyond them to have killed him off once he had done his job. So what happened to him after? But just from the stories of him going into that room, he knew that that was not anything that was, it was just another day. Churchill I had no idea that Churchill is the one who instigated bombing of civilian cities behind enemy lines. Well, no, before that, but Dresden is one that we should talk about. But before that, enthusiasm for the war was flagging in London. And so in order to give Adolf an excuse to bomb London, he ends up bombing cities. And that just, it wasn't part of war. That war was not something that happened. And is something that, you know, I wondered whether you were going to ask me about Holocaust and I wanted to look at that word because, of course, that's a Hebrew word. It's a Hebrew word. It means a burnt offering to the bloodthirsty God Yahweh, who actually derived from Set or Seeth, the Egyptian god, and that it is in thanks for a victory, a military victory, or asking for a military victory, because the God Yahweh loves the smell of burning flesh, and that's how you get him to do what you want. So if you look at what we're told to be this sacrifice of 6 million Jews, that certainly would never be called a Holocaust. But if you look at Dresden and the inferno And I have the book Hellstorm here that yes. specifically talks about it, that certainly that was a Holocaust. That was a burnt offering. And then if you look at both Nagasaki and Hiroshima, those were burnt offerings.
Yeah, so, mustard gas and they were all firebombed. Well,
all firebombed.
So,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. Michael Palmer has argued that Japan was firebombed.
Yes. And it would still fit. It would still fit because they were all civilian cities that were full of refugees, and the war was effectively over. There was no military advantage in that, except to give that sacrifice, that burnt offering sacrifice. So until the 60s, the word Holocaust meant nuclear Holocaust, and we should pay attention to that. And that change happened during my childhood because I remember, you know, hiding under the desks because that was going to protect you from that nuclear bomb. And then by the time I was in high school, we were being made to watch movies like Night and Fog. And I remember, and that's from the Eli Weisel book, Night. And so I remember going into the bathroom and fainting because it's so much trauma that you're internalizing by watching this. And so we were bombarded at that point with Hollywood movies that were all giving us that same story that we were then internalizing. But it first meant nuclear Holocaust. And I think we should be paying attention to that now that you have all these drums of war that are goading that kind of nuclear sacrifice.
Teresa, we are out of time. This is a really, really complex topic, and it's also obviously taboo in many, many circles. So for my audience who want to follow more of your work, where can they go?
Yes. All of my work is at thirdparadigm.substack.com, and that includes the videos that I put on YouTube and Rumble, and also the text, and most importantly, the comment threads. So I hope that people will go and join in, because that kind of community where you can have real conversations, I think, is where we are putting this forward.
Thank you for joining me in the trenches.
Thank you so much, Jerry.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.